into sports.
20 yards out, Hurst to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him. Yeah, no.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports. Ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Monday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.
It's spinning, it's spinning! Jonathan Sexton has made it!
Do you feel moderately happy?
No, I feel like I've been kissing my sister, I suppose.
In the pocket for his drop goal attempt, here he goes, O'Gara! He's done it! That surely is the grand slam!
We target players all the time, that's part of rugby, isn't it? Let me know.
Sexton, wonderful pass and Stockdale!
There'll be more than grenades. There'll be full tanks and full shells landing on the Aviva.
Grand Slam winners on St. Patrick's Day at Twickenham.
Now, I think it's fair to say Six Nations Super Saturday lived up to its billing. Ireland put in their best performance by some distance as well of the Andy Farrell era. Their best probably since 2018, really. 32 points to 18 winners over England. And then in Paris, the French, as probably only the French could do, scored two tries in 4 minutes, right at the death, to snatch victory. A Welsh Grand Slam up in smoke. What it all means is this Friday, if France beats Scotland by 21 points or more, with the bonus point, obviously, then the championship is theirs. We have Brian O'Driscoll with us. Hey, Brian.
Hi there, Joe.
And Keith Wood, evening.
Hey, Joe.
Ireland 32, England 18. Not just the result, Keith, which was very good, but a performance to match as well. Feels like a long time since we could come on here on a Monday and be, positive about an Irish performance. It was great.
Well, I think so. An awful long time, actually, since we've seen anything approaching that standard. And it was magic. It was magic to watch. I think it's why the game is so good. When you see a team turn up in that fashion, and there were changes, big changes than what we've seen over the last few weeks, and that makes it just a tiny little bit. I don't want to be frustrated with it, but I feel we could have seen some of those sooner. But I thought from a man to 23, we were fantastic. It was a joy to watch. The whole weekend was brilliant, but I think that set it up perfectly. That is as good as we've played since 2018.
Brian, I know you make a point of watching the games twice, three times, sometimes the week afterwards. When it comes to Ireland, that hasn't been so much fun of late, but those tries, I'd say, were good fun to watch back.
A whole lot was, Joe. I actually even really enjoyed the first 15, 20 minutes when Ireland weathered England's storm. Three or four minutes into the game, I thought, uh-oh, we're in trouble here again. Just the physicality that they brought. They had some really good initial kicks from both Youngs and Ford. They squeezed pressure. Their defence looked big. They turned us over, pushed us to the sideline a couple of times, eked out penalties. I just thought, oh no, here we go again. How are we going to match this? And then for me, there were kind of in that 15-minute period, there were three pivotal moments that changed the course of the game. And we always talk about Six Nations and Test Match Rugby, fine margins and momentum. Well, for me, these were huge momentum moments in the game. The first one was Itoje being held up over the line, where they went for the flat ball, almost a bullet in the head at one to the prop, but Itoje catches it, and Ty Byrne jumps across. They pile over, and Billy Vunipola should have been able to secure the ball, and it should have been a try. Probably lucky that Tadhg Furlong didn't give away a penalty as well, but then we got a penalty from the ensuing scrum. There was moment number one. Moment number two was from Robbie Henshaw, where he stopped Ford on a scrum, or it was a driven line out, where he stopped Ford from offloading to Watson, and he's gone. That's a try. That's going to be 8 or 10 nil and a different complexion on the game. And then the third moment was a minute later. Robbie Henshaw, for me, was head and shoulders above everyone else. Tadhg Byrne is in the conversation, but he was outstanding. But what he did in this sequence, and people should go back and have a look if they have the game recorded or watch on the player. His defence, his ability to read what's happening and react to it is like nobody else on our team. His defensive reading, but his tackling is equally good. So he tackles Johnny May, I think it was, and then realizes that there's five backs stuck over in the 15-meter channel. And so he works to the far side of the pitch where England go again, makes a big impact on Ollie Lawrence, and then Conor Murray wins the shoulder on Vunipola, and we get a penalty for neck roll. And from that penalty, we go up and score Keith Earls' try. So that just shows you got to soak pressure, take it, and then counter punch. And that's exactly what we did. And then the momentum that we built on the back of that Earls score was the building block for the rest of the performance.
I think everyone's raving about Henshaw, right from his brilliant solo try in Paris back in November, Keith, through to this entire championship. And maybe it's fitting that Brian's talking about that opening 20 minutes when Ireland were up against it a bit and not everything was going their way, as has been the case at times in this championship. Henshaw in particular has managed to thrive even under the gun a bit.
Yeah, and I was a little bit worried that we'd moved him out to 13, and I know that sounds kind of unusual. It isn't too far, but the other guy in this call will say how difficult 13 can be. But he'd been playing so well at 12. We've had times when we've played him out of position and he hasn't, it's taken him a while to settle in. It didn't take him any time. And that first 15, 20 minutes, he was truly phenomenal. He caused, every hit was at the perfect level. This will become part of the topic later on, that you have to hit high enough and not too high, and you have to hit with enough force and not too much force where you lose your control. I thought his control in that 15, 20 minutes was phenomenal. And that's just incredibly comforting to everybody around him. Yes, he did spot a couple of things very early. He made the right play very early. But he looked like he just did, like for 15, 20 minutes, he was phenomenal. But he continued that for the rest of the game. So look, it was a very complete performance by him. I actually thought he was class. I thought so many players put their hands up for man of the match, because there was a huge amount of little things that happened during the game that you say, wow, that was amazing. You know, that deserves more consideration and more talk. But then you had to move on to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. But I felt that after the, I think after about 7 or 8 minutes, I think England looked a tiny bit panicked. They were being knocked back. They're not used to being knocked back. They were shocked to their feet. They're a little bit shell shocked. Mm. And then when Ireland got the chance and they go for that kick to touch, and you say, God, you'd like that kick to have been a bit closer to the try line. That's a bit too far out, you know. But that was a perfect execution of play. Absolutely perfect.
It was interesting. So you're talking about the Earls try, obviously, on 22 minutes, which really, you know, such an emphasis and change of momentum, Brian. Jack Conan was talking afterwards and he said, Tom Curry was the tail gunner in the line-out, but we'd planned for him not to be there because that's how England had set up during the campaign. So we thought it would be a free run, that I would come around, catch the ball and have time to square up and either take an inside or an outside option. Obviously, the picture changed, but to be fair to Earlsy, all I had to do was pop the ball down to him. He did all the hard work. What an incredible finish. So plan move, and then, you know, some good decisions and reactions in the midst of it too.
Yeah, it's really interesting, you know, that different line-out plays become in vogue. And the same can be said for back plays as well at different times. And almost they're forgotten for 6, 7, 8 years. And then, bang, someone produces it. I saw something on social media today of a Leinster try from Jamie Heaslip doing the exact same, where Easton Asie was involved. I think I might have even been playing in that game myself against Spirits. So it must be the guts of 10 years ago. So these plays, you know, if clever line-out operators like Paulie is and others around the world will manipulate defences. And all you can do is analyse with the expectation that a team is going to do a particular thing. It's about how you react when they do something different. And with regard to Jack Conan, I think he's absolutely playing down. All I did was pop it down. If you watch the actual skill of what he does while Tom Curry is hooking one of his hands, he manages to grasp with the two of them, but then ultimately just flick it with his left hand down into Keith Earls' breadbasket. That is a really, really difficult skill under pressure at full reach. So, you know, I think he should be lauded for what he did and his own performance. I probably, you know, I asked some questions about you know, the toughness and the nastiness. We had it in spades. We had an all-encompassing performance. I thought he carried when he needed to. He hit rucks when he had to. He tackled efficiently. He obviously got his try. So, you know, with the departing CJ Stander, we were thinking, where is our goal forward going to come from? Well, that just gave us a huge sense of relief that we have a Jack Conan in that form that's capable of picking up where CJ leaves off.
Mm. And it was just a fill up on so many levels, Keith. Obviously, look, to get the first try of the game and all the energy that comes with that. But even I saw a stat that of Ireland's last 200 tries, 50% of them, 50% of them have come from off line out play. You know, and it's been such a brilliant weapon down the years. And even of late, you know, and going back right through 2020 as well, these brilliant Joe Schmidt starter plays or set plays or power plays or whatever you want to call them, these little set moves, they had disappeared. And we thought, well, you know, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater here. So it was actually great to see one of those plays back. And you look to Mike Catt and you look to all the team and you say, OK, a bit of creativity. It's great.
Well, I think a lot of those tries come from mauling them over. You're on 5 metres out.
Sure.
This was, you know, and this wasn't a beautiful, it was an incredible throw from Herring. I mean, he is throwing really, really well. It's a very tight spiral. The ball is getting through the air really, really quickly. Under pressure, that pop down, it's directed down more than a pop down. And Earls is kind of, you could see his eyes going left, a little half shift off his right, and then a big punch off his left leg. And people say he burned Johnny May. I thought Johnny May did unbelievably well to get back. Johnny May so quick to get back to make the tackle. Earls only just got over the line. Yeah. But it was an incredible finish. And it was exciting. And, you know, normally you have a crowd that goes ballistic when that happens. And But you could see the excitement from the players, from every one of the players that was in there. You could see Conan looking for Earls immediately afterwards, saying it was almost like you owe me a pint now, babe, you know. And there's a bit of that which was great. And from then on, now even before then, for me the big change to it. So Brian talks about moments that have changed. For me, what had changed was that Conor Murray wasn't looking to see where his 10 was. And he wasn't always passing to 10 either. He was looking to pass, not dead flat, but relatively flat. He was never looking over his shoulder for where it was going. He was hitting whoever was the first receiver. Mm. And he wasn't looking to slow down the ball to kick it. Even when the Gary Owens were going up, it wasn't, let's put three guys into the ruck, slow it down. It was, everything was done at a higher level of pace. Mm. And we, you know, like England looked as if they were totally uncomfortable because the speed of everything was up a different gear. And so from that try, when that try went over, and of course Sexton is kicking like a dream at the moment, and that's the best I've seen him play in, I would say, four years, maybe three, 4 years, 2018 definitely. But his goal kicking then is just so easily certain that it's going over the bar. But from that moment on, Ireland were flying. We're not in control, because you can't be in control that early in a game, but they seemed to be incredibly confident, and England seemed to be sapped of confidence.
Which brings us to Jack Conan's try then, Brian, and you can give us your thoughts on this. There's a lot going on here. I mean, I think every player bar Ian Henderson touched the ball in those 3 minutes. It's interesting, you know, if the theme of the previous four games has been Ireland running into an English wall and not getting very far. For a while, I thought that was happening. And then I think Furlong might have made a break. And like, you know, as only Furlong can, there's an offload to Stander and they're moving again. It was 17 phases when Sexton kicked for Keenan to make that brilliant catch. And then on it went again. What jumped out to you?
Yeah, I think the great thing about it was it wasn't perfect, but it felt great because there was no panic. Even in the situations, their shape looked good the whole time. There was lots of late footwork at the line. They weren't lining themselves up, you know, maybe with the exception of CJ, who's the only guy that's capable of putting a hole through the middle of someone. You saw some huge collisions between him and Billy Vunipola over the course of the game. No wonder the guys decided enough is enough, the damage that he's taking. But I just felt as though the organisation and the decisions to hold the ball, the little pop in and out, the tip on or the tip in, you know, in the case of the tip on, you have to be very careful as to not get taken out as the ball carrier. If you tip the ball on to the outside guy and you don't have a support runner on your inside, you're going to get turned over. So even the understanding of when they were in pods of two, when they were in pods of three, when to carry, you know, when to pull the ball out the back, there was huge variety. But I think what I really enjoyed as well, they were playing around a little bit, but they were still going forward when Johnny decided to go to the kick contest. And it felt like the kick was used as a weapon rather than as a shield. Yeah. And I think that's the mentality. That is the difference of how you create something positive from going to the air rather than, oh my God, we've run out of ideas. Mm. Let's go to the air. And then obviously, you know, the manner in which he stuck it right on Elliot Daly, who was, you know, had to do a counter movement jump versus, Hugo Keenan's line coming in, his elevation in and knee into Elliot Daly's backside is, you know, was pure AFL. It was just textbook stuff. And then the quality of Bundiaki's pass to get it out to Conan, who shipped it on to Stander when Dave Ewells was putting massive pressure on him. I just thought all of it was excellent. There was no panic, but the execution and the quality of play across the board, even when it didn't go perfectly, to just, all right, next play, let's go again. And then Conan, the way he identified the Cowan Dickey, wasn't sure as to whether he needed to go blindside or not and power over from 6 meters out. You know, that still took a fair bit of finishing. Mm. So I just thought there was so much positivity in it because we showed an array of skills and a versatility to how we can actually play the game by playing tight, playing wide, offloading, footwork, going to the air. It had everything.
Yeah.
It's funny, Brian. I didn't like the kick. When the kick was going up, I said, no, don't kick it. We've numbers out there. We're okay. We can attack wide out there. But it required the kick to be perfect. And it then required the chase to be perfect. When you said not everything was perfect, those two parts happened to be perfect. Perfect kick, perfect chase, perfect leap, great ruck immediately. And then it went back to the rest of the play. But I just thought the reaction of pace, running onto things, very flat passing, square hips all day, actually. And look, it was an extraordinary score and a great reach, because they're the reaches that can just be a bobble that the ball drops out of your hand just as you're trying to put it down, because there's always somebody going to come flying in, and it wasn't. It was perfect play.
I presume as well, Brian, must be a huge difference if you're a Sexton. I mean, this applies as well to the disallowed try. The greatest try will never score, probably. When you're moving forward with your kick as opposed to on the back foot under pressure with your kick, I mean, that's why one of the reasons the kick is perfect for Keenan.
Yeah, it is, and that's the thing, you know. Also, it's the level of pressure coming against you, and the time you have to pull off your skill, or you know, sometimes that extra half second just settles you, knowing that you can get absolute perfect contact from it, which is exactly what happened from Sexton on the try. But you know, we saw him again later on, like I said, about with Earls, with that no try on penalty advantage. You know, a really good kick and a phenomenal put down from him. Such a shame that was chalked off because of Cian Healy's knock on marginal things. But it just felt as though they were really enjoying themselves once they got into it and realised they had at least parity on the collision winning, and then they had the ascendancy. It just felt as though it came much easier. And there's no shock there. This is a collision winning game that we play. And when you get the impetus, everything else becomes much, much easier. The speed of your ruck ball, the defense on the back foot. And we talk about it the whole time, but it does become really simplistic when you start winning that kind of corridor of power.
Mm. Yeah, I'm interested as well, Brian, just on, like, we've been asking here for a while, let's get our wingers more involved. Well, the wingers were in often as first receivers. I know we've seen a little bit of that with James Lowe, but even Aki went into scrum half at one stage. You know, if everything seemed to be about making the ball go faster, whatever was happening, just move it on. If there's somebody isn't there, we're not waiting around for anybody. Mm. And what I really liked, actually, was at times the way the English defended the back of our lineout. They were double banking at the back. So the only option on is to throw to the front. But if that happened, almost certainly the winger became the first receiver and who passed then to 10, because we wanted width, we looked for width immediately. And that makes a huge difference.
Well, do you know what it does as well, Keith? It gives your best passer, you know, puts them into second distributor. And we used to do it a bit, you know, back 10 years ago, be it Rog or Johnny, where I'd sometimes go in at first receiver, get the ball out to them, and you obviously either had their wiper kick, an ability to, you know, put a long searching kick over the winger's head, or to play that wide pass out to your 15 or out to your blind winger working around the corner. So I think there's a lot of merit in that. It's probably the most I've seen Keith Earls coming in at first receiver, and Johnny sometimes needs to be told, get out there, because he likes dictating play. Whereas, you know, if he's not in the perfect position, if you have to work hard to get outside him and you might be null and void, much better off getting in a first receiver, pushing him out. And I think they're learning a lot more about that under Stuart Lancaster at Leinster as well. If you watch them, how often they'll come in rather than run to the end of a back line as a Larmer or one of the outside backs, they'll plug themselves in and push the guys that are in there out further. It's an easier thing to do to actually have a relative involvement in the move. So I think there was so much good stuff with regard to that. And it just feels as though, you know, Johnny's talked over the course of the last few weeks about, It's coming. Mm. We're going to click. And none of us believed it because we hadn't seen proof, to reinforce the thought process that this might actually be coming. And then finally you get one of those performances. You go, oh, okay, maybe it is there. Oh, well, we get the pennies dropped now. You weren't just trying to support your coaching ticket and telling them that we're doing a great job because you're captain and that's your role. You genuinely believed it. And credit to them that they did believe and then they were able to back it up.
What is the difference? Is it the pace? Is it winning the collision first?
Yeah, for me.
Is it just on that, or is it also, for me, it seemed to be a bit of a mindset change that it wasn't about short pops nine to a forward. There was a couple of cases in the last few weeks where Johnny almost had his back to the nine. He wasn't ready for it. Because there was an idea.
Johnny's been guilty of that in the past. Yeah. Of thinking a phase ahead and a setup phase rather than always, if you're an option for every play, the defense is able to read, you know, you're not interested. You're organizing something out the back. It means it's going to, the pod that's coming is going to hit that up. So if you're an option every single time, it's only a fraction of a second of concentration needs to be dropped or an interest level through the back. And that's where those little tip-ons work. And that's where an offload is created, or that's where a little bit of footwork gets you in behind the defensive line a meter or two. And then you strike on the next phase. So it really is the tiny margins, and they just managed to win more of them than they lost at the weekend.
And as a sort of guideline for what we'd look to do going forward, are we trying to say that we want to play at the highest level of pace possible and that everybody can be a receiver, because that's what it looked like. And that is a big difference, you know, from where we've been.
But can we ultimately compete physically with all of the teams in the world? No, we can't. We can do it sometimes when we're emotionally charged against England and we feel as though we've a point to prove, and CJ Sanders' last game and all of these very emotive things. You can't back that up week on week. And in a World Cup, when you have to do that against France, against South Africa, against New Zealand, against England, against Argentina, we can't connectively do it against these different teams. So we have to find a way to actually play a brand that, yes, we can do that sometimes, but we also play fast and frenetic, a bit like Japan did in the World Cup. You know, they used their skill set as best they possibly could. They came unstuck against South Africa as they just got beaten up. But we can take on these big teams. I just don't think we can do it time and time again. And that's why we've got to find a way to just think our way around them a little bit more. And I felt we did that by the variety, by not just charging in one-off runners anymore, not pods around the corner. It felt as though there was viable options. And once everyone is a viable option and you can pick one, two or three options, your defenses start getting a little bit softer, you give inside shoulders or you read through, and that's when the opportunities arise. And that's where the heads up football that they've been banging on about comes to fruition and serves its purpose.
Mm. So that's why suddenly the English wall of the last four games doesn't look like an impenetrable wall again.
Yeah, because Johnny's that viable option outside the pod each time that he's not trying to organize the next phase. That stuff makes a huge difference. Mm. It really does. And then, you know, on top of that, England are a front foot defensive team. They want to make big impacts and then they want to race off the line. If you just check them a little bit, get a yard in behind them, and they're unsure of where the offside line is, that just creates that element of doubt where they can't accelerate that first four or five paces off the line to scare you into doing something you don't want to do.
Keith, by the way, on the way, this took us a bit by surprise. I didn't suspect, talking to you last Monday after the Scottish game, you saw this coming by any means. Took you by surprise?
Oh, no, I knew it was going to happen. Yeah. Absolutely by surprise.
Because you were pretty. I would have said, down about the Scottish performance despite the win.
I was down by the fact that I felt we were being put under far too much pressure because Johnny was too deep. And that was the issue for me. He was back very deep. He was passing it. He was being ignored by the defensive line. He was never much of an option. Contrast that to Saturday, when he took the ball into contact three or four times. He's not fast anymore, but you still have to be there for him and you still have to tackle him because he's looking to offload. So that becomes a threat. For me, Conor Murray didn't run with the ball at all the other day, but he defended like an absolute Trojan. But it was his flat passing an awful lot. Now, it was accurate passing. It was either to a pod that was running or flashing it out the back, but it wasn't back 7 yards. That's the difference. Mm. I felt Johnny was running onto everything. I felt whoever was the first receiver was. And actually, as it turns out, I think if you change up who the first receiver is, that takes a huge amount of pressure off Johnny so that he's not thinking for 80 minutes solid over what's going to happen in the next three or four phases. And like, I often wonder which is cause or effect in terms of this. Is the fact that you're trying to hit an awful lot of things much flatter, that speeds it up? I know winning the contact speeds it up as well. But I felt that the pressure we were able to put onto an English defensive line that was never fully back in line because everything was much quicker. So even when we would win certain contacts, we often slow down our rucks a little. The speed of the ruck, but the speed of the ball out of the ruck, be it by hand or by kick, was drastically different. You know, there was no time. There was no time left for England to kind of go and do anything. Now, I felt England were, I think they were shell-shocked. I mentioned that at the start. But like, England played last week at a higher tempo entirely than they have for about since the World Cup semi-final. They were phenomenal last week. And they weren't. I don't think they got a chance to do it. I think if we had slowed the game down, we'd have been bullied off the park. And it's trying to figure out where's the cause or effect. So there's a couple of bits one way or the other, but I still don't quite know what's the one thing that changed, or was it 10 things that changed?
It shows as well, Keith, that how much of a game collision sport is an emotional game, and it's an emotional state. And even the subconscious of England winning last week versus losing, if they had lost against France, they simply couldn't have, they would have come with the mentality that we cannot leave here without a victory. Now, they still would have been thinking that, but not to the same degree. And desperation is an incredible thing. Ireland have been trounced by England, beaten badly the last four occasions, and playing scared is a really, really dangerous weapon for teams. And if you can get the emotional component right and marry that with the skill set and the collision winning, it is just it's a force to be reckoned with, and it's very, very difficult to beat. And it's difficult to do that every single week, to get yourself to that emotional state again, but they managed to do it. It's easier to do against England because we love playing against England and we respect them as a team. But it's not easy to get yourself in that state against Scotland and against Italy and against Wales. It's just not. So they have to find a different way over the course of the next couple of years to make sure that those standards are still able to be realised, even though the emotional state won't be the same as it was on Saturday.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I have to take a short break. We've mentioned Henshaw and Conan and Sexton and Murray a little bit, and I guess Earls. Who else caught your eye, Brian? Who else were the big performers? I know there were lots out there.
Yeah, Furlong, obviously. Henderson's been outstanding, I think, in this championship. CJ was excellent again. You know, I talked about some of those collisions that he made. But do you know what? What's almost a shame, you know, an extra shame around his retirement, is that I feel that there's been a real evolution to his game in the last year. that we've seen offloading, we've seen passing, we've seen something that we didn't see for the first 4 years of his international career. And now it feels as though that next level, he's making a little bit more space for himself because people have to respect the fact that he is going to offload. He's going to do something different other than carry directly into them. So it feels as though we are losing a player that has enhanced their skill set, is getting progressively better as well. But I think everyone played well. I think Keenan was good at fullback. Even Jacob Stockdale, who people will say had a quiet game by his standards, I thought he did everything really well. He cleared out one or two really important rooks, passed well, you know, low errors. Even the Ben Young's try, I wouldn't blame him for that. I think that he's got to go for that intercept, to be honest with you.
Okay.
So I was really pleased for him that he had a really solid performance and worthy of a call back in.
Mm. There was a moment, Keith, where I think it was off a restart, important enough period in the game, and Itoje went up high and took it, and Tig Byrne, that blue scrum cap, is everywhere, and he sweeps in before Tom Curry, and it's another turnover. I think Ireland had 12 turnovers in the end, but it's a penalty for Ireland as well. I mean, you see his hands, he looked big enough for a second row at the weekend. He has had such a championship.
Yeah, I thought he was very lucky in that instance, because I thought Tadhg Furlong was stuck on the other side of the ruck before he went into it. There was a kind of a meeting at the same time. Though I love that. I love to see when something like that happens. Look, there was loads of turnovers. There was loads of carries. There was very good foot movement. Actually, Henderson, as always, has got very good foot movement just before contact. But there was one great one 2 minutes into the second half. England get a penalty, kick it really well down into touch. So it's just inside the 22. It's a brilliant place for them to get back into the game. And Curry gets penalised. And I would say, God, what a stupid penalty to give away. I mean, they need to spend time in the 22 for England. And then you look at it again and you rewind it back a little, and Tadhg Byrne pulls Curry around towards him. He pulls him into the offside position. The picture it paints to the referee is that Curry has tried to stop and step in between him and Tadhg Byrne, but Tadhg Byrne pulled him in. It was class, actually. It was one of those things now that would drive England absolutely crazy. And he can't be penalised for it. There's nothing wrong in him doing it. Of course, it's a little bit cynical, but it was brilliant. Now, it's a tiny thing, but suddenly, I'm not saying that England would have gone on to score, but this was their chance to get back in the game, and suddenly you're deflated again. So he did huge amounts of those during the game. Again, he's another guy I was saying, God, don't put him into the second row. I don't want to see him get tired, you know, because second row is just such a horrible position to play. It's so hard, heavy hitting, draining from the legs. And you know that England are going to try and scrummage really hard. I'd like to see him stay on the flank. And I was wrong on that again, because his performance from the second row was like a fourth back rower. So that was pretty fantastic. Mm. So, look, I got excited by the way they all pretty much played.
Yeah.
And something then that really I love seeing, and I loved it when I played, was if you can get the opposition bitching to the ref. You know, if you know that they're getting angry with every decision, if a decision goes against them, refs are only human too. And if someone is shouting abuse at you, you might penalise him the next time. You know, it's if it's 50-50, it may not be 50-50. And that happened very early. Ireland seemed to be quite calm. England were bitching at everything. There was back chat in the scrum, a lot of chat from the props, and the props were getting screwed. Furlong was magic.
That said, if you're Ellis Genge, it seems that you can do what you want, admit it, and it's all fine. We'll come to that in a second. Rugby and Off the Ball is with thanks to Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team of us, everyone in. Very quick break, and we're back with Brian and Keith in a second.
Monday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.
Now, you're welcome back. If you're just tuned in, Brian O'Driscoll, Keith Wood with us. We have largely dissected, minute by minute almost, you won't blame us, the Ireland win over England. Just two quick points of discipline and then what it means for the coaches before we finish up on events in Paris. I mentioned Ellis Genge before the ad break there, Brian. I mean, it seemed at one point when Johnny Sexton said to the referee what had happened, Genge said within earshot of the referee, yeah, I did. What, you know, what are you going to do about it? He's not going to be cited, I find surprising.
Yeah, it is. Like, obviously, this, you know, takes two to tango. I'm sure he's reacted to the fact that Johnny's probably holding on to him on the ground, but you just can't do that. And it looked as though it certainly warranted a look from the TMO, but for some reason, the siding commissioner, I don't know, maybe it's to do with the lack of clean blows, which is not, you know, rationale for penalizing them, that they felt it wasn't a red card offense. At worst, it's a yellow card, and that's why he's not being cited. He doesn't land anything substantial, and maybe that's the reason for him getting away scot-free. But it's surprising that there wasn't a look from the TMO, unless he had a quiet word to the referee and said, "There's nothing to see here," which is surprising in itself.
Mm. Keith, the Bundiacchi red card mightn't have been a red card in previous years, but it very much is these days.
It is. It's a straight red card, and it's unfortunate. Look, I would say for coaches and players that, Bundy was shaking his head going off the field. Well, he hit him on the chin, you know, with the top of his shoulder. You better make certain that you're tackling lower. And I know that Vanapola was running and obviously dipping his head into it, but Bundy stepped up into him. You know, it was making a tackle that he's made consistently, match after match, year after year, and has done it really, really well. Well, unfortunately, you just can't run that risk anymore. So he has to be lower to make that happen. I keep hearing people saying the game's going soft. It is just not soft. That game is tough, and they don't want any bangs to the head. So the changes that are being made are essential. It's just very, very difficult. So your body position has to be lower at the start.
When I was watching, like, sorry, Joe, I was watching the game again, like, there were lots of instances where it was a very close run thing with high shots. Like, Tom Curry early on in the first half hit Tig Furlong off a ruck, and geez, you know, he didn't leave much room for margin for error. You know, he's 2 or 3 inches higher, and that's a shot into the neck, and you're looking at definite red card if you do that. So they are trying to reduce. We still have to continually feel pain, this pain of losing men to the sidelines, if we are going to change habits. And that's the reality of it. This isn't going away. We're not all of a sudden just going to go, oh, now it's fine again. Everyone's going to have to change their behavior at training and in matches. And if you know if you go high and you miss by even a fraction, you're going to get a red card. And it'll take a year, 2 years for fully to you know, progress into the mindset, into the thinking. If you think about it, how many spear tackles are there these days? How many challenges are in the air are there these days? None, because players don't do it anymore because they know the ramifications. So it's just a matter of time before the penny drops on this too.
Keith, the final one, and what all this means for Andy Farrell, probably can't overstate it in many ways. There were definite murmurs and, you know, jury out type vibes, and they would have grown massively if Ireland had been on the end of a pumping at the weekend, as it happens. And Brian's point about, you know, replicating that emotion again and backing it up, notwithstanding. But for Farrell, instead of the next few months being, you know, pieces written and just a kind of air of negativity around him and around the team for the next couple of months, it's the opposite now. And the same for Mike Catt, because the attack was so good. So you can't really overstate maybe what a fork in the road this could be for his tenure.
Well, I think it takes a lot of pressure off him. I would say that it's been a while coming. That we've said it here, that Ireland have been playing some fairly boring rugby. That wasn't even vaguely boring. I mean, that's very exciting. There was great structure to it. There was also great reaction to it. There was a little bit of unstructured play to it. And that's compelling now, and winning too, which is, it's grand being entertaining, but you want to be able to win as well. So I think he takes an awful lot out of that. I think between himself and Johnny and Mike Catt, they have to make certain that the other 10s that come in are able to play something similar. But I felt that the load was shared, and I felt for an awful long time that too much of the game went through Johnny just on his own. Actually, ever since Brian retired, I felt that there was too much of the weight on one player all the time. So if other people are coming in, if you have different first receivers, if you have different options all over the place, life becomes an awful lot easier. Then you can you then a lot of the pressure is off. But I would be saying we haven't seen any of that, and nor do I think that this is everything solved. I think it was an amazing performance against England, to beat them very, very soundly. And it's something you have to enjoy. So the team have to enjoy it and Farrell has to enjoy it. But he wants to be able to replicate that every time Ireland go out in the field. And it doesn't have to replicate the emotion, you know, but you have to be able to replicate a high level of performance. And so we've had low performance, I think, and this is very high performance. That's the bit we have to replicate.
On Eddie Jones, Brian, when they're good, they're very good, as we saw against France. And that said, it's been a poor championship. Where does it leave Eddie Jones? Would you still have faith he's absolutely the right guy to lead them over the next couple of years, or is he under big pressure now?
Was, you know, listening to the players, I saw Maratoji and Maku Vonopola came out and were waxing lyrical about how great he is, one of the best coaches they've ever been coached by, and it's, you know, it's on the player, on the player's shoulders, you know, the responsibilities of what's happened in this year's Six Nations. But inevitably there's going to be pressure on Eddie. The fact that he's not picking Sam Simmons, he's not picking in-form guys like Marcus Smith in Quinns, who's flying, even the likes of Danny Kerr and Mike Brown are going well for them as well. I think you, to get the crowd and the public on side, you've got to start an integration process when things start getting away from you. And there hasn't been, there's been a loyalty to the Saracens players that hasn't been returned from their point of view. And I think he now has to start looking at some new blood in there. I think it's, things have gotten a little bit stale and some players are low on match fitness. That's a clear sign that he just needs to shake things up a little bit if he's to stay in there. England have not turned into a bad team overnight. We could go out next week and they could beat us by a similar scoreline. That's the reality of their caliber. So they can go away and fix this very quickly. It's just, I think they're going to have to make some sharp changes, and that'll only come from, you know, personnel getting the skids put up underneath them and fresh people coming in and really challenging them for their places.
If anyone didn't catch France 32, Wales 30, well, that was your mistake. Extraordinary. 17 points apiece at halftime. The French scored two tries. Wales responded each time. And then it looked like Josh Adams had really given Wales the initiative. With 3 minutes to go, 14-man France needed two tries against 13-man Wales, and 13 men clinging on for a Grand Slam. Olivan on 77 minutes. Brice Doolan on 82 minutes. I mean, I don't know what the odds were, like, I don't know, 50-1, 100-1, that you're going to score two tries in the space of 4 minutes. Only France in some ways, Keith. This was just nuts.
Yeah, only France, but also, like, Wales have ridden their luck for the whole championship. Everything has kind of fallen their way, and they needed to be able to close out the game. So their discipline under pressure, and, you know, unless you're on the field, you know what that level of pressure is in those big games. Your brain was, they were gone, they were shattered. They were, there could have been another couple of guys sent to the bin because they were flopping on the wrong side. They were being unbelievably cynical. But they also, they were so fatigued, some of their thinking when they were trying to play out the end of the last minute or minute and a half for the last try. It was so sloppy. I mean, so unbelievably sloppy. But I love the fact that the kick, you know, I thought they were going to have to kick it an awful lot further in France, and they didn't. They kind of tightened, having kicked an unbelievable kick on the other side. I think Penno had on the other side to kick it into 5 metres. This was 20 metres out. And they still kept a high level of discipline. Look, it was an extraordinary, extraordinary finish to an extraordinary game of rugby. And France are a joy to watch. They're just, I mean, they'd still drive you mad. And they still, of course, got a red card in the middle of it. And I'm scratching my eye. And, but, I mean, it's amazing stuff. It's just, like, it is fantastic. And some of the Welsh players were incredible. Like, truly incredible. But, you know, it was a lunatic last 5 minutes of rugby.
Woody, what did you make of France taking those scrums with 5 minutes to go? How they didn't tap and go? And there's like 90 seconds it took for the scrum to take place when they've got 5 minutes to go. I was like, what are you doing?
Well, it's only in the last 6 months that people have started tapping and going again. And you mentioned earlier on that there's a kind of rotation, that the more you forget, you know, there's new things happen, but they happened 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. Tap and go, you control the ball, you know. I couldn't get it, couldn't understand what they were doing. But I honestly felt they were all shattered. This is a fit French team, the fittest I've seen for quite a while. They're younger. I think they have a higher work ethic. I think Sean Edwards has been, I'd say he's drilling them into the ground to get them to think the manner in which he wants them to do it. I do think they're fitter, but they were shattered as well. Some of the thinking in the last 10 minutes was just, you know, was way out there, you know.
Finally on that, it's really interesting, and I saw you guys talking on Virgin, Joe, about, you know, Fiku's line, and it was magnificent. But for me, it was actually his work rate. If you see the second or the last ruck that happened before it goes to the pod and out the back to Ntamack, he's actually loitering in behind, and then he goes off camera. So he busts a gut to actually get out and become the 3-on-2.
Right.
He doesn't do that, they don't score. So whatever about actually getting out there and making a good decision and squaring George North up and throwing a good pass and then a second good pass to actually be out there was, for me, the difference between the two teams. And probably he doesn't get the credit for doing that. The easy option, because defensively, some of the Welsh players were really struggling to get into the line, could have worked harder, massive fatigue. He had to be feeling huge fatigue, but he still managed to get there, and he still managed to pull the trigger on a great decision, a great pass, and that's the margins at the top level.
Yeah. Just one very last point, and sorry, time's totally gone against us completely. Fabien Galthié was complaining about the Welsh, and even the Paul Williams red. He said, if you watch the Wales players, it feels like they specialise in making sure opponents get red cards. Their body language is quite clear. I hope the referees take that into consideration. If you watch the video, he's talking about the red card here. There's clearly no contact. Sorry, if you watch the video, there's clearly contact. I don't know what the hell he's talking about here.
He wears very funky glasses. I'm not quite certain he can see through them. But look, he can't see what he's doing, but he has his hand around a player's head. And you can see the pressure that's in around his eye area, you know. So
it's funny. Keith Ronan was saying on the coverage that you know, if the right referee at home, you might get away with that still in the top 14. So that's maybe why that behaviour is still a little bit there.
Yeah. Well, look, it can't be in the game, so you can't, and it won't be. It won't be a short. The referees are the. The disciplinary group will not be taking into account that he isn't making any contact, because it looks like he is.
Chris Ashton got 10 weeks for that, for something similar.
Right. Okay. Well, Fabien reckons not even a red, so there we are. So Friday, Scotland, 21 points plus. We'll talk about that over the coming week at some stage. There's just so much going on. Clock is against us. I mean, my only regret, Brian, is that frankly we haven't been able to spend 10 minutes analysing O'Gara and Sexton in the Breakfast Club.
One of the greatest ever pieces of content I've ever seen. Genius. The fact that both of them literally could have been in the movie. Like... One of my real favorite flicks as well, The Breakfast Club.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. But it was nice while it lasted for the 42 years. But it was outstanding. I laughed out loud. My wife was really wondering what the noise was from upstairs, and I was busting my backside laughing when I saw it when it came in, and I couldn't wait to get it out to the masses as quickly as I could.
Keith, I know you're not a social media man. Have you seen this?
Do you know what? You're going to be very, Brian will be entertained by this. I have not seen it. My wife mentioned it to me, but I've never seen Breakfast Club.
Oh, for God's sake.
Well, I knew that would upset you, but no.
Well, this
you don't
is
know what the, you're missing. Go and watch it on Saturday.
This
you got
is
a Saturday off.
This is the way to watch Breakfast Club in this 2 minute clip. We'll send it on to you and be interested for your thoughts on what's going on. Fellas, brilliant stuff. Thanks so much. Brian O'Driscoll, Keith Wood. We'll talk to you again.
Monday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.